And now may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts be always acceptable in thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Welcome to our healing service. We don't normally read that long of a passage, but maybe we should. One of the reasons why we chose that is you can't grasp the whole thing of what Isaiah is saying unless you just, maybe you could just pick and choose, but, anytime you start seeing that lectionary where it's like verse 8 through 13, 15 through 16, 19 through 23, it's like something's up. Why do you keep cutting out these verses? And usually they're the verses that talk about like God's wrath or, something that people are like, let's just move past that. But this Isaiah passage, it talks about how, we'll get to it. Tonight we're looking at the idea of mother wounds. And kind of what we do at this healing service, if this is your first time, is we have different topics that we've picked out to cover. Later when we have time for prayer, you're free to bring anything that God has brought you into this place to receive healing for. Whatever that thing. It could be a bad back. It could be a bad marriage. It could be the burden of that you've been carrying from a pain from your mother. And that's one of the things we want to talk about. And one of the things that we look at every week is how all of these, some of them hit us more than others. But one of the beauties of Christian theology is that it really boils all suffering and sin down to some very common elements. That in the sense of so that you and I can actually have a lot of compassion for each other. My sin might look different from your sin, but it's all rooted in a lot of the same things, that we fundamentally are not God, and we wish we were. I mean, that's really at the base of all sin, is kind of rooted in that. And so let's talk about your mom. And again, this is my weekly caveat, that I'm not a therapist. I have been to therapy, but that doesn't make, I've eaten at McDonald's, that doesn't make me a burger or something. I don't know. I can't remember what my youth pastor told me growing up. But what makes a good mom? Or maybe let's talk about what do you need from a mom? What do you need from a parent? Now I know the nurturing. There we go. We can have some call and response. What anybody else? What makes a good parent? Love,
kindness,
caring, compassion. All right. Yeah, all of those things. Your mom was great. All right, we're going to start that off. Some of you might come in really defensive about your parents. Some of you aren't at all, and you're like ready to go. You're like, no, skip all that part. I got plenty. Let's just get to the mother wounding. But sometimes some of this we have to kind of coax out of people because we have this innate defense of our parents because they were our parents. And sometimes we almost don't want to admit some of the harm that was done. Because it feels like it might be opening a door that you don't know what is behind that door, right? You don't really want to look there. It'd be easier just to kind of move forward. Your parents were great. Yeah, they weren't perfect. That's what people always say. My parents weren't perfect, but they were fine. And you're like, well, what's the not perfect part? Where did that touch home for you? I was listening to a podcast by a therapist named Adam Young, and he talked about six things that every child needs from their parent. Six things that every child or you might find as you're reading it, you're like, no, I still need that. But these were six things that when you were younger, that every child, when you were little, from the time you were born, growing up, maybe even young adulthood, when you're in middle school or high school, that you needed from a parent. First, he said, you needed attunement. Attunement. Attunement is the ability that your parent has, that your mother had, to notice you. To notice, not that she was a mind reader, but she could tell when something was up. She could tell when your face had fallen. She could tell, when you weren't really yourself. Maybe you didn't experience attunement because you always felt like my parents don't know the only way my parents are ever going to notice anything that's going on is if I have to tell them. I have to actually come out and tell them. They're not pursuing me, trying to, hey, I can just notice that you seem sad. What's going on? So attunement was the first thing. Responsive. In other words, that maybe when they did notice that something was up, they actually responded towards that. They actually moved towards you. Adam Young talked about how some of us want to say that our parents weren't attuned, because it's almost worse to feel like they were attuned, that they just didn't respond. Maybe it'd almost be worse to know my parents did know what was going on. They could tell that my face had fallen, you know, that they could tell that I wasn't myself, and they just couldn't approach it. They were just leaving me to myself. Because that means they knew something was wrong and they just didn't do anything. He said that we need engagement. Did your parents, did your mothers express a desire to know you? Not just to get you where you need to be or get things done or make sure that you're doing the right stuff, but actually know you. Know what are you passionate about? What are you loving? What are you enjoying? What makes you sad? What makes you angry? Like, what, I'm just interested in you from a curious place, not from a, I'm trying to, you know, fix you, or I'm trying to, kind of, you know, make sure that you're, I'm checking in just to make sure nothing's bad, right? You know, it's like the weekly little check-in, like, everything's good, right? Okay, great. I'm going to leave you alone now. One therapist said, named Kurt Thompson, said that each one of us, I love this quote, each one of us comes into this world looking for someone looking for us. Each one of us comes into this world looking for someone looking for us, that we want to find someone who wants to find us. And was that your parent? Was it your mother? Was it your father? Was it your mother? Somebody who said, you, looking back, you were, and as a caveat, no one does this perfectly. But they would say that, they said that these six things are things that your parents, did more often than not, we could say. Fourth was to regulate your affect. Your affect being your internal state, whatever's going on, that a parent, what their job is to help you regulate that. So for instance, an infant is completely devoid of any ability to self-regulate, right? You know, if you have a newborn, if they're sad, they're crying, and they can't soothe themselves. I mean, this is why, I remember when I was growing up, I worked in this, it was called First Tuesdays at a local Baptist church, where they would bring in, these, adults in the area who had some kind of mental disability. It was kind of a night for them. They'd have dinner of a thing. And there was one guy there who you know, some people had very obvious, disabilities. One guy, I mean, he was, you know, he wasn't as bad as you might expect. And you could have a lot of conversations with him. And, you know, at times you'd think, you know, why are you here? And he would talk about why he's there, that, he grew up in Romania as an orphan in an orphanage, and he was never held as an infant. They were just put into cribs, because there wasn't enough people. And that actually did profound mental damage to him, that he isn't able to have the same kind of mental ability that you and I have, because an infant is unable to control their affect. That's why a mother soothes, comforts, nurtures. A father can do that too. And as your kid grows, that what a mother is to do is to help them continue to do that. And as you regulate their affect, you're teaching them how to do it, so that when they're adults, they can regulate their affect. You know, when they're sad, they can actually deal with their sadness and not need to go and find you know, something to distract. You know, something to, you know, I've been watching, I'm on my 30th rerun of The Office, because I don't want to admit that I'm just really sad, because I don't know how to control that, you know. I'm not right now. So a good parent, one thing that a child needs from a parent is to regulate their affect. And if your mother was distant, maybe at points, you became too much for your mom. Maybe she even verbalized that, like, you're too much. Maybe there was, you can remember as a child crying, and your mother just could, I mean, it was just at the other side of the room. I'm not dealing with it. Go figure it out. Not when you're an adult. I mean, there's a difference between dealing with an adult and a child. I mean, when you're a child, you need to be nurtured, comforted, soothed, so that you can learn how to do it. Fifth, was that a parent needs to be strong enough to handle your negative emotions. Negative emotions being things like anger, sadness, rage, depression. You know, anything that is kind of emotions that we would consider on the negative side, that parents who, what children need from their parents is parents who are okay enough to be able to receive that. In other words, that your sadness wasn't uncomfortable for your mom. Your anger wasn't uncomfortable for your mom. That she could just deal with it and say, wow, you're really angry right now. Wow, you seem really sad. Instead of what we normally do as a parent, I say this for myself, is let me cheer you up. Let me, whatever this is, I don't want to deal with it. So let's distract you. Let's find something else. Or if you're angry with me, how dare you? You know, like you're ready to go. You get defensive. You get deflective. You get, you know, if you ever felt like growing up, every argument with your mom, she never heard you, because it felt as soon as you started, you know, saying what was frustrating you, she just turned it back on you. Well, you have no idea what it's like to be me. You have no idea what it's like. You have, you know, whatever, which has nothing to do with whatever you were saying, right? I mean, it's a complete. Okay, maybe I don't, but that does nothing to do with whatever I just said that I feel angry about. She got defensive. Yeah, any of those things. And then the last thing was a willingness to repair when there was disconnection. A willingness to repair. When you and your parents were at odds, who made the first move to heal that? Was it your parents? You know, if you stormed off into your room, was it your mom who had the soft knock at the door? Hey, can we talk? You know, whatever that was, like, I just want to make sure that we're okay. Can we process through that together? Or was it, if you stormed off to your room, they were going to leave you to it for as long as, you know, and it was up to you. The only way, you know, did you grow up feeling like the only way that this relationship gets repaired is if I go and do it? That's actually not the role of the child. It's actually the role of the parent, right? It's not the role of the child to seek reconciling with their own parents. And he said all these, and I say all these just for you to kind of maybe just as a diagnostic for did anything as I was even just talking about that come up of moments where you're like, yeah, my mom wasn't able to do that. I'm not saying she's a bad mom. I'm not saying I don't love her. I'm not saying that she didn't love me, but I am saying that yeah, I had a bit of a wounding there. You know, it was communicated to me that I was too much. That whatever my emotions were, whatever my anger was, whatever it had no place here. Get it out. Go talk to your dad. You know, or whatever. And in all these places, there's something there in which we did not receive what we needed. We didn't receive what we needed, and therefore, there's something lacking. There's something that we are missing, and that thing that we needed as a child is love, and not love in an abstract way. It's easy for a parent to say they love their children. I love my children because I want you to know that I'm a good guy. And what good person doesn't love their own children, right? So I will declare I love my children. But if love is not just a state of being, but a verb, how often do I actually love my children, you know, and love them well? You know, I won't tell you. You know, it's easy to say I love my husband, but how's that actual relationship going? You know, I mean, what do you do to actually love him and love him well? And so anyone, yes, of course, we'll say, unless you have evidence to the contrary of like, no, my mother genuinely did not love me. And that happens too. And that's probably a whole nother, talk, but there's still some things in common with this. But all of your mothers probably would have said they love you, you love them, but you did not receive the love that you actually needed. And therefore there's something missing. There's some kind of wounding. And so I want to marry that. I want to merge that with a doctrine, and this is where we'll end. A doctrine that is kind of a heady doctrine in Christian theology. It's called the aseity of God. The aseity of God. A-S-E-I-T-Y. Aseity. In Latin, ase means of himself, of itself. And what it means is that God is not, he is in need of nothing. It's kind of a philosophical term, but it's basically this idea that God, nothing acts upon God. God is not lacking anything, that he needs repayment. Nothing, he's not suffering from anything. Some old theologians have said that he does not suffer passions. We might use the word emotions, which growing up for me, it made God, whenever I heard this, it made God sound cold, that he doesn't have emotions. But fundamentally, if you'll just go with me for a second, what it really means is that, there is nothing behind or around or above God that's telling or forcing God into positions. Let me explain what I mean. Your mom most likely had a lot of goodwill and wanted to be a good mom. And yet, as a creature, as a person, as a sinner, there were moments in which she was unable to do the things that she needed to do. That's just a fact, a reality of life. You, as a mom, were this. You were not a perfect mom. All right? You, as a dad, are not a perfect dad. Right, everybody can kind of probably admit that. And what that means is that there are moments when your mom thought, I know what I probably need to do here. I know that my child's upset and I need to comfort her. But honestly, I'm too tired and I can't do it. I mean, if you've ever been around somebody maybe it was your spouse who said, I need to talk to you, and they were just so upset, and you've just gotten home from a long day, and you're just like, I can't do it. I'm sorry. I know that's hurtful. I know it's painful. I can't do it. That is actually what aseity is talking about, that nothing is acting upon God that would influence him in any way. God is not caught up in his own emotions that he's no good to anybody else. You know, there are moments in your mom's life, maybe there are periods in your mom's life when she was sad. Maybe when your grandfather died, your mom was just sad and she had no ability to be there for you in college. You know, or something like that. She was so caught up in her own grief, as a human being, that she wasn't able to be a mom. In that moment, that the aseity of God and what the scriptures talk about, when Paul says that when he says the God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. In other words, God is not needing anything. This is the contrast in Isaiah's passage where these human beings are making idols that have no life in and of themselves. The idols they're making are totally contingent on a human being forming them and making them and turning them into whatever it is. And those human beings aren't even in and of themselves okay. It even talks about how the blacksmith, as he is making his god to worship, he gets tired and has to take a break. He has to eat food. I'm exhausted. He has to get a night's sleep. The carpenter, as he's making his idol, gets hungry. And he actually has to make a meal and cook a dinner. And then he's like, well, whatever food I have, wood I have left, I'll make an idol out of it. And then it's all contrasting this utter insanity of these people who are totally and utterly needful of everything around them. And they make something that has no life in and of itself. It can't give them anything. They literally made it out of iron and wood. And then they say, save me. You are my God. And the thing they made just sits there because it has no life. You know, it's not, and it has no ability to give life. And what Isaiah is doing is contrasting it, saying you are turning away from the living God, the God who has life in and of himself, who needs life from nothing, who is needful of nothing, who is not suffering of any passions. God doesn't have a bad day. He doesn't not get enough sleep. He doesn't just have a few moments He doesn't get depressed. He doesn't suffer the things that you and I suffer, which means not that what I grew up thinking means God is cold. It means he's utterly removed. He doesn't care. No, it actually means that God is able to be 100% compassion and empathy and love. That because God is not needing anything, it means that God is all giving in everything that he does. In every single moment when you as a child needed something from your mom and your mom just wasn't able to do it because she's a human being, God is able. He is not at any moment suffering from anything that would stop him from being fully and completely your God, who has promised that you will be with him. And that he will care for every single need that you have. Every single sorrow, every single piece of anger. That God, if we go back through these six, that God is completely attuned to you. He knows you inside and out. He knows everything that's wrong with you. Everything that's bothering you. Everything that's frustrating you. He sees it, every single thing. He knows you better than you know yourself. And he is responsive. He is moving towards you in love. He's not standing far off saying, you got to get your life together. He is saying, I'm here right now, coming to you. He's engaged to you. The passage says that the people could find God. Not that he's hard to be found, because in him we live and move and have our being. That he is comforting you. That he is there to offer comfort for sinners in his word and his promises. That there are moments in the healing service where you actually feel comfort. Not just, oh, I'm comforted in an abstract way, but in a way of like, I came into this service carrying a weight and I left it feeling freed. That's God. That's God as a mother, as a comforter, as a parent saying, whatever you got, bring it to me and I'll take care of it and I'll comfort you. He's strong enough to handle your negative emotions. I mean, he really is. He's strong enough to handle your rage, your anger, your resentment, your tears, your sadness. There is nothing he is nervous about with you. There's nothing he's insecure about. He can take it. And this last one, this willingness to repair when there's a disconnection. I don't even think I have to say it, but I will. That God is always and will always be the God who makes the first move. That if you have been wondering, what does God think of me? If you've locked yourself in your room after an argument with God as a teenager, if that's where you're at right now and you could be 80 years old and you are in that room as a teenager, it's God gently knocking at that door saying, hey, let's talk. It's God who is pursuing you, chasing you down. The song we're going to sing after this is a song that talks just about that. And my invitation to you is just to lean into it. Whatever it is that you felt like you didn't get from your mom or whatever ways in anything that I mentioned today that connected with you, this idea that you're being confronted with a God who is not needing anything. He is all love towards you. And he is a love that will chase you down. He will always chase you down. You could never run far enough that his love cannot catch up to you very quickly. He has big steps. Just like when my 2-year-old runs away from me, I can track her down pretty quickly. That's God for you. That you might be running your little legs as fast as you can, and he is one step away from swooping you back up into his arms. Because he is the love that will never let you go, will chase you down and hold you even to the end. Amen.